And I invite you to listen to these ancient words from the mountaintop that Martin King referenced not so long ago. But these words go back a long, long way. From Exodus 20. And God spoke all these words to Moses. I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other small g gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the waters under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. Our second reading comes from a text, the author of which we do not know, a later letter in the New Testament called 2 Timothy.
You should know this, Timothy, that in the last days there will be very difficult times, for people will love only themselves and their money. They will be boastful and proud, scoffing at God and ungrateful. They will consider nothing sacred. They will be unloving and unforgiving. They will slander others and have no self-control. They will be cruel and hate what is good. They will betray their friends, be reckless, be puffed up with pride, and love pleasure rather than God. They will act religious, but they will reject the power that could make them godly. Stay away from people like that.
Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust consume and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust consumes and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. No one can serve two masters, for a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon.
So, idolatry is a, boy, an old-fashioned, kind of scary religious-sounding word.
Idolatry.
In the Hebrew scriptures, idolatry had a really specific context, which was the Israelites coming into a land that worshipped a lot of other gods. Baal, who was a god of fertility. There was the god Moloch, who we don't know too much about the god Moloch except that he demanded child sacrifices. There were a multitude of deities that one could put one's faith and trust into. And as they were coming into the new land, the Israelites were warned, don't jump into that. You had a God who brought you out of slavery, a God of liberation, a God of freedom. Don't re-enslave yourselves in a culture that doesn't believe in liberation and freedom. Now, idols back then were carved out of wood. They were made out of gold. They were made out of silver. The psalmist who wrote Psalm 115 was seemed to take great delight in going, they have ears, they can't hear. They have eyes, they can't see. And the people who carved them are just like them. They have noses but can't smell. Actually, they might smell terrible. We don't know. But we don't do much bowing down before literal statues of Marduk or Baal or Moloch anymore. But I would posit that we still are big into idolatry. We just don't do it quite so literally, perhaps. It seems like Western culture, especially Western consumer culture, endorses two kinds of idolatry nowadays. We really like to shrink the God who is beyond imagination, the God beyond our human ability to comprehend. We like to shrink that God down to a controllable, easily digested size, to shrink God into a mere object rather than subject. Shrink down to an object that we can have a certain amount of control over. If we say the right prayers, we'll get the right results. We send the right amount of money to the TV evangelist and we'll get the right kind of blessings back. This is God, the divine Santa Claus in the sky, the divine bubblegum machine where we put in the right prayer, we put in the right sacrifice, we put in the right this, and we'll get back this shiny, sweet thing. At the same time, we take those things which are not God and elevate them to a central part of our soul, our psyche. We take things that are not God and give them our ultimate trust or time or worship, put them at the center of our consciousness. Can you all think of what operates as idols in our culture, or if you're brave, in your own life? I'll just say right now, I put this on the cover because this is one that I spent far too much time on. My idol in terms of time, if not effort or emotions, is social media. I started, sound like an addict, it started innocently enough. This was how I communicate with my church folk. But I actually got a piece of software that measures how long you are on over the course of the day, because I'm like, I'm only on for 2.5 minutes. But I do it again and again and again and again, because, oh, I got to get this thing out, or I have to find out what Pastor so-and-so said. And eventually it goes, you were on for 45 minutes today. It's like, oh, was I in prayer for 45 minutes today? Yeah, no. It writ large that here's where's your time is. What I love about this illustration is that Facebook is really good at letting you think you're actually getting a view of the world and where your friends are at and where your parishioners are at. In reality, it is keeping the door to real life from opening up fully. So that's mine. True confessions. How about for y'all? Or not for y'all, but for our culture. What acts as idols nowadays?
Garage.
I'm sorry?
The garage.
Things that are in the garage. Like what? What kind of stuff's in the garage?
A car.
A car, okay, yeah.
Tractor.
I hadn't thought about tractors before, okay. Things in the garage. What else? Idols.
Technology. Well, you think about everywhere you go, every street corner in a major intersection, there's a bank, there's a pharmacy, and there's a nail salon.
A bank, a pharmacy, and a nail salon. Yeah?
Nail.
Did I say nail? No. Nail salon. A spa. A mail salon. That's what we call the post office. No, a nail salon. All right. And a bank.
Politicians and sports figures.
Sorry?
Politicians and sports figures.
Politicians and sports figures. Yeah, sports idols. We even use that term, don't we? Movie idols, sports idols. How about some others?
Savings.
Sorry?
Savings.
Savings as an idol? Well, all right. We'll put that in. Savings.
Maybe only when we get old.
Yeah. Right now, it's spend, baby.
Ideally,
yeah. I'd like to have that more of an idol. Yeah, Barb?
I would say security, and that nationally, I think security is an idol, but also for myself.
So security, knowing things are okay.
Savings gives you security. Then
you know yep. Savings give you security. What other things promise security?
Plastic surgery.
Plastic surgery. There we go. Other things. What promises security?
Power.
Food. Sorry, I need to pump up my hearing aids. Food.
Hearing aids. Sorry.
Sorry. I didn't hear that either. Food. No, really, I didn't.
Hearing aids.
Oh, hearing aids. Oh. I do not put my trust in hearing aids because they're always not working. What else gives you a sense of security?
Jobs?
Home?
Money.
Running? Oh, money. Money. Put it right out there.
Doctors?
Okay.
Exercise.
Family. Sexy.
Yeah.
I've heard.
I think people find security in conformity, in not locking the bolt.
Conformity.
Faith.
Family? Jesus actually warned about family quite a bit, didn't he? But it also, even within the church, has become rather an idol.
Acceptance.
Say that again?
Acceptance.
Connected to conformity, yeah. I grew up as a Navy brat, and my dad, when they became... started taking their Christianity seriously, he was very reflective about how much, especially in the early 80s, how much language about our ultimate security being connected to our nuclear weaponry and our military, because he was a part of that. He was very sensitive that our military was becoming an idol, in his opinion. We were putting our ultimate trust for our well-being and safety in idols of not gold and silver, but of titanium and carbon fiber. Other things.
The right to bear arms.
Right to bear arms. Guns are lifted up as this is the thing that will keep me and my family safe. And we will bow down before that at any cost. All right. So, what does a gun do? What does money do? What does Facebook do for you? What does it, actually the word was sent around itself. What does it offer you? Or what does it give you an illusion of?
Security.
Safety and security. And what is underneath our need for safety and security? What's the emotion that's underneath that?
Insecurity.
What?
Fear.
Fear. Fear is what's underneath our need for idolatry. Fear. Idolatry is about having a sense of control to assuage my deep psychic fear about not being safe, not being in control, not being able to be in charge of my own destiny. I want security. And I want safety. And wealth can bring me a sense of that. If I've got a big old buttload of money, I can have my will done. You, servant, go do that thing. You, underling, go do that thing. Here, I'll throw some dollar bills at you. You get stuff taken care of. Money gets things taken care of. That gives you safety. Does your tractor do that? I'm not so sure.
Well, it's a status symbol.
A status symbol.
So
Okay, cars and a really nice tractor.
Yeah.
Stuff in your garage. I understand. So that gives you status, and status is a sense of security. That means I'm making it better than my next door neighbor. And boy, do they want my John Deere. Yeah. Okay. Fear. Anybody here a science fiction fan? Read Dune, Frank Herbert? Dune? Frank Herbert wrote, "Fear is the great mind killer." St. Thomas Aquinas, who Frank Herbert might have been quoting, we don't know. Thomas Aquinas wrote that fear is the great killer, not of the mind, but of compassion. Fear is the killer of compassion. Fear is such an emotional, powerful emotion for humans that when we allow it to take us over, it drives compassion right out of our hearts. We are no longer able to connect to other human beings as fellow children of God. What's the opposite of fear?
Faith.
In the classical sense of trust, not a set of intellectual truth claims, but trust. The opposite of fear is trust. Putting our ultimate trust, our ultimate faith, our ultimate allegiance in something is what faith is. And for us as moderns, just as much as it was for Moses' folks back 3,000 years ago, where do we put our ultimate trust? Where do we put our ultimate allegiance? Where do we put our time, our effort, our money? Where do we put that? Do we put that into things and stuff? Or do we put that to the God who is beyond human imagination? Jesus used a parable to talk about what it is to trust. He told parables about ravens and lilies of the field. Do you remember what that was about? Ravens do not plant, they do not sow, and yet God takes care of them. Lilies do not have day jobs, and yet they are clothed with such beauty. How much more will God be present for you and take care of you? They don't worry how they will get their needs met, and God provides. God provides the food, the sun, the rain that is needed, and you can worry all day long. You can fear all day long, but will not add one day to your life. Now, Jesus is not saying be gullible, be foolish. He also said to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. But it does mean walking the journey of life, knowing that the universe is not cold and unfeeling chaos. But God has put us in a universe that, as Martin Luther King said, bends toward justice, bends toward love, bends toward compassion. Love for Jesus and for King, for all the great spiritual teachers, for Gandhi, the most powerful antidote to fear is love, which is based on trust, as you said, Paul. 1 John, perfect love casts out all fear. Cure for idolatry, then, is trust. Trust in the power of love, trust in the author of love. And that's a, boy, trust is a hard thing. That's why idolatry is so attractive, because we're called to trust in love, which is a thing we can't see, we can't weigh, we can't measure with a ruler. Being called to trust in love, either the love of a human being or the love of the divine, is really a tall order because we can't see it. I can see a Smith & Wesson. I can see a Trident missile. I can see a brand new Mercedes in my driveway. As one evangelist said, I can see my new jet plane. Those are concrete. You can measure them. You can see them. You can add up how many zeros you had to put on the check to buy it. It's easy to trust in stuff. But over and over, Jesus talked about how ultimately, everything that is stuff will break, rust, die, turn to ashes. Every human-made thing, every idol we make is finite and is not going to be there when you need it. Jesus said, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear. Don't be fearful about what you need. If I fear, I don't trust anyone or anything except me and my stuff. If I fear, I need to accumulate stuff. If I fear, I need to build bigger barns. If I fear, I need to build walls and create enemies and suspect others and distrust the motives of everyone else. If I fear, I will distrust grace, and I will distrust love, and I will distrust the benevolence of the God who is love itself. If I fear, I have to do it all on my own, and I'm going to depend on my stuff to make it happen. I am the one I need. Mine is the voice I will heed. Everything else can go hang. That is the place of idolatry. The way we get toward trusting and not fearing, according to some of the great spiritual teachers, is not working really hard to trust, because you can't do that. It's like picking up yourself up by your bootstraps. It's living your life for others. It's living a life of generosity that is able to change our perspective, to be able to learn how to trust and connect to others. Elizabeth Johnson wrote, I have heard many different regrets expressed by people nearing the end of life, but there is one regret I have never heard expressed. I have never heard anyone say, I wish I hadn't given so much away. I wish I kept more for myself. Death has a way of clarifying what really matters. Generosity teaches us that our lives and our possessions are not our own. They belong to God, and we are merely stewards of them for the time that God has given us on this precious earth. Now, we rebel against that simple truth because we want to be in charge of our lives and our stuff. It gives us a sense of control. It helps assuage our fear at the most obvious level. But the truth that our stuff is not ours, our time on earth is not ours, if we learn the more difficult truth that we and all we have and everything we see belongs to God, it means actually our future is secure beyond measure, because it doesn't have to depend all on me. It can depend on one who is beyond my imagination, one who is beyond any measure. Jesus said, do not be afraid, little flock, for it is Abba's good pleasure, it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Your grandma might have said it this way, count your blessings. Did your grandma say count your blessings? And it sounds so cheesy, oh my gosh, but it's a profound truth. Count and name your blessings. Count and name the relationships and the experiences that matter in your life, and they will show up more than a garage full of stuff. It helps us learn how to be consistent and persistent in choosing the path of love, of life, of servanthood, of justice and mercy when we count those relationships that matter, our connections to other human beings that matter. It moves us away from trusting in the stuff. Counting blessings makes us feel like we have more. Rabbi Lawrence Kushner wrote that wealth is not a function of how much stuff you have, it's a function of generosity. The more you give, the richer you feel. Generosity is an aspect of love. And that's what we're called to practice. To move us away from idolatry, it requires living a life of love. And the only way to practice it is by doing it. Life is practice for life. Love is practice for love. Generosity is practice for generosity. It all ripples into God's great story of us. Sherry Dietz, this was a quote, because it was long, but I'm gonna read it. Sherry Dietz connected to your grandma, saying, "Practice naming blessings. The elements of abundant life that Jesus described throughout the Gospels, things like relationship, community, love, and purpose, may be less tangible, but they are also more powerful than material goods, and each of us experiences them every day. The joy of a good conversation, the sense of purpose that comes from helping one another, the warmth of a loving relationship, the feeling of community from gathering with friends or family, the awareness of how many ways we are blessed each and every day, these things are palpably and powerfully available to us. But an entire media universe pushes us to tune into what is negative or missing rather than what is positive and right in front of us." So Reverend Sherry Dietz concludes saying, "I invite you to begin a daily practice of noticing, naming, and giving thanks for blessing." Our practices shape our beliefs much more than our beliefs shape our practices. This is one of the powerful truths that Buddhism is helping teach Christianity in the 21st century. I love Martin Luther. But if there's one thing he made an error of, is he said, "What you believe, what intellectual assents to truth claims you make in your brain will change the way you live." And to a certain extent, that's true. But much more so, the way we live, the things we do, the things we practice, will change the way we believe. If you spend time praying every day to a God of love and generosity, you will have a different worldview than someone who spends all their time looking at catalogs and thinking about how scarce everything is and how much they're missing. How we practice, how we live, how we love will affect and change the way we believe. Our truths about God, our truths about humanity, our truths about each other. Probably no one lived that out in the 20th century better than Martin Luther King did. At least nobody did it as publicly and powerfully as he did. Martin Luther King did his doctorate at Boston University School of Theology, where Barb and I went. And you come out of Boston University, if you get a doctorate there, you have a heady, heady, amazing intellectual faith. That you can hang out in ivy covered towers, and never have to come down. And if you see some of King's early writings, he sounds like a PhD candidate, man. He's talking Bart and Bultmann and Tillich and all these guys who use really huge words. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But at some time in his early career, he knew he had to make a choice about how he would live as part of the academy or as part of the people God called him to serve. So he wrote this. He wrote this in the letter from the Birmingham jail. Do folks know the context of the letter from the Birmingham jail? King was jailed for doing some protests. And lots of well-meaning, middle-of-the-road clergy folk wrote to him and said, well, they wrote a letter as a group. Black pastors and white pastors, mostly white, but they call it white moderates. We applaud what you're doing. We applaud the aims you have. We applaud where you're going, but you're just going too fast. Protesting's not the right way to do it, Martin. Be patient. White folks will come around. It'll all be good. And King wrote to them, calling them on their idolatry of safety, their idolatry of security. And he said, I choose to identify with the underprivileged. I choose to identify with the poor. I choose to give my life for the hungry. I choose to live for and with those who find themselves seeing life as a long and desolate corridor with no exit signs. This is the way I'm going. If it means suffering a little bit, I'm going that way. If it means sacrificing, I'm going that way. If it means dying for them, I'm going that way. Because I heard the voice saying, do something for others. We all hear that voice. But he took it all the way. Lent at its most powerful can be an amazing experience of listening for that voice and discerning how it is we're to leave, what to live. What are the practices we can take on that can help us to see that we live in a world gifted with abundance, and we are called to live in it and share in it and live in it and love in it. Our culture says it's all about scarcity. We have a finite pie. And if you get a bigger slice, that means I get a smaller slice, so grace says it's not a finite pie. Jesus turned all of it upside down. He said, those who are spending all their time trying to find their life, they will lose it. Those who want to be first will be last. He had an upside down kingdom that said that what the advertisements are telling you and what the magazines are telling you, and what the people in power are telling you is a lie. Don't look out for number one. Look out for the least and the last and the lost. Don't strive after idols. Strive for love. Strive for what he called the kingdom or the realm of God, which was a place where love is the last word and life is the last word. We only have a couple more weeks of Lent, but I invite you to spend some time examining where are the false places of your own security? What are the idols that you bow down to? What are the places that gives you a sense of power or security or feeling smart or sexy? Or able to handle it all on your own. Try to identify those places. And then see how you can move beyond them. with love, with generosity, with forgiveness, with sharing, with putting your life on the line for another, rather than the culture that says, you're the center of the universe, it's all about you, you're worth it, you deserve it. You are a precious child of God, but not because you're the center of the universe, you're a precious child of God because love is the center of the universe. And the God who is love invites you to a fuller life than what the idols offer. Amen.